But to defer thought in this way was something like trying to talk without singing in her own ears. The thought that is bound up with our passion is as penetrative as air. Everything is porous to it. Bows, smiles, conversation, repartee are mere honeycombs where such thoughts rush freely, not always with a taste of honey. And without shutting herself up in any solitude, Gwendolen seemed at the end of 9 or 10 hours to have gone through a labyrinth of reflection, in which already the same succession of prospects had been repeated, the same fallacious outlets rejected, the same shrinking from the necessities of every course. Already she was undergoing some hardening effect from feeling that she was under eyes which saw her past actions solely in the light of her lowest motives. She lived back in the scenes of her courtship with a new bitter consciousness of what had been in Grandcourt's mind, certain now, with her present experience of him, that he had a peculiar triumph in conquering her dumb repugnance, and that ever since their marriage he had had a cold exultation in knowing her fancied secret. Her imagination exaggerated every tyrannical impulse he was capable of. "I will insist on being separated from him," was her first darting determination. Then, "I will leave him whether he consents or not. If this boy becomes his heir, I have made an atonement." But neither in darkness nor in daylight could she imagine the scenes which must carry out those determinations with the courage to feel them endurable. How could she run away to her own family, carry distress among them, and render herself an object of scandal in the society she had left behind her? What future lay before her as Mrs. Grandcourt gone back to her mother, who would be made destitute again by the rupture of the marriage, for which one chief excuse had been that it had brought that mother a maintenance? She had lately been seeing her uncle and Anna in London, and though she had been saved from any difficulty about inviting them to stay in Grosvenor Square by their wish to be with Rex, who would not risk a meeting with her, the transient visit she had had from them helped now in giving stronger color to the picture of what it would be for her to take refuge in her own family. What could she say to justify her flight? Her uncle would tell her to go back. Her mother would cry. Her aunt and Anna would look at her with wondering alarm. Her husband would have power to compel her. She had absolutely nothing that she could allege against him in judicious or judicial ears. And to insist on separation, that was an easy combination of words, but considered as an action to be executed against Grandcourt, it would be about as practicable as to give him a pliant disposition and a dread of other people's unwillingness. How was she to begin? What was she to say that would not be a condemnation of herself? "If I am to have misery anyhow," was the bitter refrain of her rebellious dreams, "I had better have the misery that I can keep to myself." Moreover, her capability of rectitude told her again and again that she had no right to complain of her contract, or to withdraw from it. And always among the images that drove her back to submission was Deronda. The idea of herself separated from her husband gave Deronda a changed, perturbing, painful place in her consciousness. Instinctively, she felt that the separation would be from him, too, and in the prospective vision of herself as a solitary, dubiously regarded woman, she felt some tingling bashfulness at the remembrance of her behavior towards him. The association of Deronda with a dubious position for herself was intolerable. And what would he say if he knew everything? Probably that she ought to bear what she had brought on herself, unless she were sure that she could make herself a better woman by taking any other course. And what sort of woman was she to be? Solitary, sickened of life, looked at with a suspicious kind of pity? Even if she could dream of success in getting that dreary freedom, Mrs. Grandcourt, run away, would be a more pitiable creature than Gwendolen Harleth, condemned to teach the bishop's daughters and to be inspected by Mrs. Mompert. One characteristic trait in her conduct is worth mentioning. She would not look a second time at the paper Lush had given her, and before ringing for her maid she locked it up in a traveling desk which was at hand, proudly resolved against curiosity about what was allotted to herself in connection with Gadsmere, feeling herself branded in the minds of her husband and his confidant with the meanness that would accept marriage and wealth on any conditions, however dishonorable and humiliating. Day after day the same pattern of thinking was repeated. There came nothing to change the situation, no new elements in the sketch, only a recurrence which engraved it. The May weeks went on into June, and still Mrs. Grandcourt was outwardly in the same place, presenting herself as she was expected to do in the accustomed scenes, with the accustomed grace, beauty, and costume. From church at one end of the week, through all the scale of desirable receptions, to opera at the other. Church was not markedly distinguished in her mind from other forms of self-presentation, for marriage had included no instruction that enabled her to connect liturgy and sermon with any larger order of the world than that of unexplained and perhaps inexplicable social fashions. While a laudable zeal was laboring to carry the light of spiritual law up the alleys where law is chiefly known as the policeman, the brilliant Mrs. Grandcourt, condescending a little to a fashionable rector, and conscious of a feminine advantage over a learned dean, was, so far as pastoral care and religious fellowship were concerned, in as complete solitude as a man in a lighthouse. Can we wonder at the practical submission which hid her constructive rebellion? The combination is common enough, as we know from the number of persons who make us aware of it in their own case, by a clamorous, unwearied statement of the reasons against their submitting to a situation which, on inquiry, we discover to be the least disagreeable within their reach. Poor Gwendolen had both too much and too little mental power and dignity to make herself exceptional. No wonder that Deronda now marked some hardening in a look and manner which were schooled daily to the suppression of feeling. For example, one morning, riding in Rotten Row with Grandcourt by her side, she saw standing against the railing at the turn, just facing them, a dark-eyed lady with a little girl and a blonde boy, whom she at once recognized as the beings in all the world the most painful for her to behold. She and Grandcourt had just slackened their pace to a walk. He, being on the outer side, was the nearer to the unwelcome vision, and Gwendolen had not presence of mind to do anything but glance away from the dark eyes that met hers piercingly toward Grandcourt, who wheeled past the group with an unmoved face, giving no sign of recognition. Immediately she felt a rising rage against him mingling with her shame for herself, and the words, "You might at least have raised your hat to her," flew impetuously to her lips, but did not pass them. If, as her husband, in her company, he chose to ignore these creatures whom she herself had excluded from the place she was filling, how could she be the person to reproach him? She was dumb. It was not chance, but her own design, that had brought Mrs. Glasher there with her boy. She had come to town under the pretext of making purchases, really wanting educational apparatus for her children, and had had interviews with Lush in which she had not refused to soothe her uneasy mind by representing the probabilities as all on the side of her ultimate triumph. Let her keep quiet, and she might live to see the marriage itself dissolve in one way or another. Lush hinted at several ways, leaving the succession assured to her boy. She had had an interview with Grandcourt, too, who had as usual told her to behave like a reasonable woman, and threatened punishment if she were troublesome, but had also, as usual, vindicated himself from any wish to be stingy, the money he was receiving from Sir Hugo on account of Diplow encouraging him to be lavish. Lydia, feeding on the probabilities in her favor, devoured her helpless wrath along with that pleasanter nourishment, but she could not let her discretion go entirely without the reward of making a Medusa apparition before Gwendolen, vindictiveness and jealousy finding relief in an outlet of venom, though it were as futile as that of a viper already flung on the other side of the hedge. Hence, each day, after finding out from Lush the likely time for Gwendolen to be riding, she had watched at that post, daring Grandcourt so far. Why should she not take little Henley into the park? The Medusa apparition was made effective beyond Lydia's conception by the shock it gave Gwendolen actually to see Grandcourt ignoring this woman who had once been the nearest in the world to him, along with the children she had borne him. And all the while the dark shadow thus cast on the lot of a woman destitute of acknowledged social dignity spread itself over her visions of a future that might be her own, and made part of her dread on her own behalf. She shrank all the more from any lonely action. What possible release could there be for her from this hated vantage-ground, which she yet dared not quit, any more than if fire had been raining outside it? What release but death? Not her own death. Gwendolen was not a woman who could easily think of her own death as a near reality, or front for herself the dark entrance on the untried and invisible. It seemed more possible that Grandcourt should die, and yet not likely. The power of tyranny in him seemed a power of living in the presence of any wish that he should die. The thought that his death was the only possible deliverance for her was one with the thought that deliverance would never come. The double deliverance from the injury with which other beings might reproach her and from the yoke she had brought on her own neck. No! She foresaw him always living, and her own life dominated by him, the always of her young experience not stretching beyond the few immediate years that seemed immeasurably long with her passionate weariness. The thought of his dying would not subsist. It turned as with a dream change into the terror that she should die with his throttling fingers on her neck, avenging that thought. Fantasies moved within her like ghosts, making no break in her more acknowledged consciousness and finding no obstruction in it. Dark rays doing their work invisibly in the broad light. Only an evening or two after that encounter in the park, there was a grand concert at Klesmer's, who was living rather magnificently now in one of the large houses in Grosvenor Place, a patron and prince among musical professors. Gwendolen had looked forward to this occasion as one on which she was sure to meet Deronda, and she had been meditating how to put a question to him, which, without containing a word that she would feel a dislike to utter, would yet be explicit enough for him to understand it. The struggle of opposite feelings would not let her abide by her instinct that the very idea of Deronda's relation to her was a discouragement to any desperate steps toward freedom. The next wave of emotion was a longing for some word of his to enforce a resolve. The fact that her opportunities of conversation with him had always to be snatched in the doubtful privacy of large parties caused her to live through them many times beforehand, imagining how they would take place and what she would say. The irritation was proportionate when no opportunity came. And this evening, at Klesmer's, she included Deronda in her anger, because he looked as calm as possible at a distance from her, while she was in danger of betraying her impatience to everyone who spoke to her. She found her only safety in a chill haughtiness which made Mr. Vandernoot remark that Mrs. Grandcourt was becoming a perfect match for her husband. When at last the chances of the evening brought Deronda near her, Sir Hugo and Mrs. Raymond were close by and could hear every word she said. No matter, her husband was not near, and her irritation passed without check into a fit of daring which restored the security of her self-possession. Deronda was there at last, and she would compel him to do what she pleased. Already and without effort, rather queenly in her air, as she stood in her white lace and green leaves, she threw a royal permissiveness into her way of saying, "I wish you would come and see me tomorrow between 5 and 6, Mr. Deronda." There could be but one answer at that moment, certainly with a tone of obedience. Afterward it occurred to Deronda that he would write a note to excuse himself. He had always avoided making a call at Grandcourt's. He could not persuade himself to any step that might hurt her, and whether his excuse were taken for indifference or the affectation of indifference, it would be equally wounding. He kept his promise. Gwendolen had declined to ride out on the plea of not feeling well enough, having left her refusal to the last moment when the horses were soon to be at the door, not without alarm lest her husband should say that he too would stay at home. become almost superstitious about his power of suspicious divination, she had a glancing forethought of what she would do in that case, namely, have herself denied as not well. But Grandcourt accepted her excuse without remark, and rode off. Nevertheless, when Gwendolen found herself alone, and had sent down the order that only Mr. Deronda was to be admitted, she began to be alarmed at what she had done, and to feel a growing agitation in the thought that he would soon appear, and she should soon be obliged to speak, not of trivialities, as if she had no serious motive in asking him to come, and yet what she had been for hours determining to say began to seem impossible. For the first time, the impulse of appeal to him was being checked by timidity, and now that it was too late, she was shaken by the possibility that he might think her invitation unbecoming. If so, she would have sunk in his esteem. But immediately she resisted this intolerable fear as an infection from her husband's way of thinking. That he would say she was making a fool of herself was rather a reason why such a judgment would be remote from Deronda's mind. But that she could not rid herself from this sudden invasion of womanly reticence was manifest in a kind of action which had never occurred to her before. In her struggle between agitation and the effort to suppress it, she was walking up and down the length of the two drawing-rooms, where at one end a long mirror reflected her in her black dress, chosen in the early morning with a half-admitted reference to this hour. But above this black dress her head on its white pillar of a neck showed to advantage. Some consciousness of this made her turn hastily and hurry to the boudoir, where again there was a glass, but also tossed over a chair a large piece of black lace, which she snatched and tied over her crown of hair, so as completely to conceal her neck and leave only her face looking out from the black frame. In this manifest contempt of appearance, she thought it possible to be freer from nervousness, but the black lace did not take away the uneasiness from her eyes and lips. She was standing in the middle of the room when Deronda was announced, and as he approached her, she perceived that he too, for some reason, was not his usual self. She could not have defined the change except by saying that he looked less happy than usual, and appeared to be under some effort in speaking to her, and yet the speaking was the slightest possible. They both said, "How do you do?" quite curtly, and Gwendolen, instead of sitting down, moved to a little distance, resting her arm slightly on the tall back of a chair, while Deronda stood where he was, both feeling it difficult to say any more, though the preoccupation in his mind could hardly have been more remote than it was from Gwendolen's conception. She naturally saw in his embarrassment some reflection of her own. Forced to speak, she found all her training in concealment and self-command of no use to her, and began with timid awkwardness. "You will wonder why I begged you to come. I wanted to ask you something. You said I was ignorant. That is true. And what can I do but ask you?" And at this moment she was feeling it utterly impossible to put the question she had intended. Something new in her nervous manner roused Deronda's anxiety lest there might be a new crisis. He said with the sadness of affection in his voice, "My only regret is that I can be of so little use to you." The words and the tone touched a new spring in her, and she went on with more sense of freedom, yet still not saying anything she had designed to say, and beginning to hurry that she might somehow arrive at the right words. "I wanted to tell you that I have always been thinking of your advice, but is it any use? I can't make myself different, because things about me raise bad feelings, and I must go on. I can alter nothing. It is no use." She paused an instant, with the consciousness that she was not finding the right words, but began again hurriedly, "But if I go on, I shall get worse. I want not to get worse. I should like to be what you wish. There are people who are good and enjoy great things. I know there are. I am a contemptible creature. I feel as if I should get wicked with hating people. I have tried to think that I would go away from everybody, but I can't. There are so many things to hinder me. You think, perhaps, that I don't mind, but I do mind. I am afraid of everything. I am afraid of getting wicked. Tell me what I can do." She had forgotten everything but that image of her helpless misery which she was trying to make present to Deronda in broken, elusive speech, wishing to convey but not express all her need. Her eyes were tearless, and had a look of smarting in their dilated brilliancy. There was a subdued sob in her voice which was more and more veiled, till it was hardly above a whisper. She was hurting herself with the jewels that glittered on her tightly clasped fingers pressed against her heart. The feeling Deronda endured in these moments he afterward called horrible. Words seemed to have no more rescue in them than if he had been beholding a vessel in peril of wreck, the poor ship with its many-lived anguish beaten by the inescapable storm. How could he grasp the long-growing process of this young creature's wretchedness? How arrest and change it with a sentence? He was afraid of his own voice. The words that rushed into his mind seemed in their feebleness nothing better than despair made audible, or than that insensibility to another's hardship which applies precept to soothe pain. He felt himself holding a crowd of words imprisoned within his lips, as if the letting them escape would be a violation of awe before the mysteries of our human lot. The thought that urged itself foremost was, "Confess everything to your husband. Have nothing concealed." The words carried in his mind a vision of reasons which would have needed much fuller expressions for Gwendolen to apprehend them. But before he had begun those brief sentences, the door opened, and the husband entered. Grandcourt had deliberately gone out and turned back to satisfy a suspicion. What he saw was Gwendolen's face of anguish framed black like a nun's, and Deronda standing 3 yards from her with a look of sorrow such as he might have bent on the last struggle of life in a beloved object. Without any show of surprise, Grandcourt nodded to Deronda, gave a second look at Gwendolen, passed on, and seated himself easily at a little distance, crossing his legs, taking out his handkerchief, and trifling with it elegantly. Gwendolen had shrunk and changed her attitude on seeing him, but she did not turn or move from her place. It was not a moment in which she could feign anything, or manifest any strong revulsion of feeling. The passionate movement of her last speech was still too strong within her. What she felt beside was a dull, despairing sense that her interview with Deronda was at an end. A curtain had fallen. But he, naturally, was urged into self-possession and effort by susceptibility to what might follow for her from being seen by her husband in this betrayal of agitation. And feeling that any pretense of ease in prolonging his visit would only exaggerate Grandcourt's possible conjectures of duplicity, he merely said, "I will not stay longer now. Goodbye." He put out his hand, and she let him press her poor little chill fingers, but she said no goodbye. When he had left the room, Gwendolen threw herself into a seat with an expectation as dull as her despair, the expectation that she was going to be punished. But Grandcourt took no notice. He was satisfied to have let her know that she had not deceived him, and to keep a silence which was formidable with omniscience. He went out that evening, and her plea of feeling ill was accepted without even a sneer. The next morning at breakfast he said, "I am going yachting to the Mediterranean." "When?" said Gwendolen, with a leap of heart which had hope in it. "The day after tomorrow. The yacht is at Marseilles. Lush is gone to get everything ready."
"Shall I have mamma to stay with me, then?" said Gwendolen, the new sudden possibility of peace and affection filling her mind like a burst of morning light.
"No. You will go with me."
End of chapter 48.
This recording is in the public domain.